This is Age of Treason Radio.
First thing I remember was asking Papa why. For there were many things I didn't know.
On the White Network.
By the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's gone. You better learn your past, you better learn your own. For someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The time and tears went by.
Welcome. The title of tonight's installment is Race and Anthropology, Part 3. I'm going to continue talking about Madison Grant and reading from The Passing of the Great Race. And here I want to focus on conveying an idea of Grant's view of eugenics and race versus nation. And I think that's useful because Grant was the preeminent anthropologist, European anthropologist in America. And so this gives us an idea of what American anthropologists were thinking as well. So let me start here by just jumping right into what he has to say about eugenics. The value and efficiency of a population are not numbered by what the newspapers call souls, but by the proportion of men of physical and intellectual vigor. The small colonial population of America was, on average, and man for man, far superior to the present inhabitants. And he's writing this in 1917. Although the latter are 25 times more numerous, the ideal in eugenics toward which statesmanship should be directed is, of course, improvement in quality rather than quantity. Skipping ahead a bit, efforts to increase the birth rate of the genius-producing classes of the community, while most desirable, encounter great difficulties. In such efforts, we encounter social conditions over which we have as yet no control. It was tried 2,000 years ago by Augustus, and his efforts to avert race suicide and the extinction of the old Roman stock were singularly prophetic of what some far-seeing men are attempting in order to preserve the race of Native Americans of colonial descent. I'm going to guess here because I don't know how that prophecy turned out, but I suspect since the old Roman stock eventually did die out, that Grant here is expressing his skepticism and thinks that whatever positive eugenics people are trying to preserve the race of Native Americans of colonial descent won't work. And just as an aside here, I make the distinction, and other eugenicists or people who have talked about eugenics have, between positive eugenics and negative eugenics, the basic idea being that positive eugenics is boosting the desirable traits, giving them, helping them to reproduce, and negative eugenics is the idea of suppressing the negative traits, keeping them from reproducing or being reproduced. Though Grant doesn't use those terms. Continuing here, man has the choice of two methods of race improvement. Here he's talking about the two methods. He just doesn't call them positive and negative. He can breed from the best, or he can eliminate the worst by segregation or sterilization. The first method was adopted by the Spartans, who had for their national ideals military efficiency and the virtues of self-control. And along these lines, the results were completely successful. Under modern social conditions, it would be extremely difficult in the first instance to determine which were the most desirable types, except in the most general way, and even if a satisfactory selection were made, finally made, it would be in a democracy a virtually a virtual impossibility to limit by law the right to breed to a privileged and chosen few. This is just one example here, that last bit of Grant's pragmatic attitude toward politics and politics as the art of the possible. He mentions that several times. I don't know if I have any more here in what I've selected to read, but it's a recurring theme in his writing. Now he's going to talk a little bit here about dysgenics, but again, he doesn't use the term dysgenics. Experiments in limiting reproduction to the undesirable classes were unconsciously made in medieval Europe under the guidance of the church. After the fall of Rome, social conditions were such that all those who loved a studious and quiet life were compelled to seek refuge from the violence of the times in monastic institutions, and upon such the church imposed the obligation of celibacy and thus deprived the world of offspring from these desirable classes. In the Middle Ages, through persecution resulting in actual death, life imprisonment, and banishment, the free-thinking, progressive, and intellectual elements were persistently eliminated over large areas, leaving the perpetuation of the race to be carried on by the brutal, the servile, and the stupid. It is now impossible to say to what extent the Roman Church, by these methods, has impaired the brain capacity of Europe. But in Spain alone, for a period of over three centuries, from the years 1471 to 1781, the Inquisition condemned to the stake or imprisonment an average of 1,000 persons annually. During these three centuries, no less than 32,000 were burned alive, and 291,000 were condemned to various terms of imprisonment and other penalties, and 17,000 persons were burned in effigy, representing men who had died in prison or who had fled the country. No better method of eliminating the genius-producing strains of a nation could be devised, and if such were its purpose, the result was eminently satisfactory, as is demonstrated by the superstitious and unintelligent Spaniard of today. A similar elimination of brains and ability took place in northern Italy, in France, and in the Low Countries, where hundreds of thousands of Huguenots were murdered or driven into exile. Under existing conditions, the most practical and hopeful method of race improvement is through the elimination of the least desirable elements in the nation, by depriving them of the power to contribute to future generations. It is well known to stock breeders that the color of the herd of a herd of cattle can be modified by continuous destruction of worthless shades. And of course, this is true of other characters. Black sheep, for instance, have been practically obliterated by cutting out generation after generation all animals that show this color phase, until in carefully maintained flocks, a black individual only appears as a rare sport. In mankind, it would not be a matter of great difficulty to secure a general consensus of public opinion as to the least desirable, let us say, 10% of the community. When this unemployed and unemployable human residuum has been eliminated, together with the great mass of crime, poverty, alcoholism, and feeble-mindedness associated therewith, it would be easy to consider the advisability of further restricting the perpetuation of the then remaining least valuable types. By this method, mankind might ultimately become sufficiently intelligent to choose deliberately the most vital and intellectual strains to carry on the race. So that concludes. He wrote much more on eugenics, I think, and it was weaved throughout the entire text of his book, but I'm going to stop there and just make a few comments myself on my reactions to this and on reading this. I would describe this fairly, because I think Grant was being straightforward. He wasn't being duplicitous. I don't think he was trying to hide his true feelings. I don't think anybody could really accuse him of that, because he used some pretty brutal language to describe what it was he wanted to do, what his vision was. But I think it's fair to describe it as a pragmatic vision of societal scale improvement. and it had an explicit preference for quality over quantity, which he made clear right at the beginning of what I read there. The improvement he saw as being accomplished by reducing problems such as crime, poverty, alcoholism, and feeble-mindedness, and that he thought that could be accomplished through the elimination of the least desirable elements in the nation by depriving them of the power to contribute to future generations. In other words, sterilization or segregation. This is negative eugenics. And he went with negative eugenics because he was a believer in eugenics, and he had this vision of societal scale improvement. And he thought that positive eugenics wasn't practical, wasn't pragmatic. So that's what drove him toward negative eugenics as the route to take. But he presumed here, and I don't think he's just paying lip service to it, but he presumed that there would be, or that he could win through argument, a general consensus of public opinion on this. In other words, a collective democratic process. And, you know, whether you agree with collectivism or democracy or not, that was what he was basing being accepted and carried forth as policy on. He assumed that he would have to get collective democratic approval for this consensus of public opinion. So he wasn't scheming here, just one of the chosen few talking in code to the chosen few about killing off the undesirable elements, you know, everybody else, all the hoi polloi. He wrote a book. He put his ideas in it, and he spoke in very plain language. So, as I said, I don't think he can be accused of being sneaky about the way he went about it, what he did. And, of course, what he wanted to happen didn't happen. To a certain extent, laws were passed and sterilizations were performed, but it didn't go on for very long. And part of the contrast here, though, that I'm trying to draw is what the leading lights in science and anthropology, in this case, were thinking back in the early 20th century. And I think if you just, from what we know of how things are today, what a dramatic contrast we see. The idea that of eugenics is considered a moral outrage. It's morally outrageous that this is just absolutely unacceptable, that people plan to improve themselves. I mean, as individuals, fine. As a human race, fine. But anything in between, nope, not allowed, at least not for white people. And, you know, there's no bones about it. What Grant was proposing was based explicitly upon discrimination and exclusion. And I did a whole installment focused on that issue, those issues, and this scares people. There's been quite a bit of scaremongering about, you know, what this means for the people who might be excluded. And it triggers fear. And, you know, if you're of the wrong race or not pure enough, I would say even a bit of paranoia. And the fear maybe is justified in people who have a parasitic mindset of wanting to ride on other people's abilities and other people's work, exploit other people. As you can see, Grant wasn't talking about exploiting these undesirable elements. He was talking about separating from them, being free of them. And that puts the fear into anybody who suspects they might be gaining more from being around people like Grant, and would lose if they were excluded from participating in a society of Grant's. So another element of Grant's work that I want to wrap up with here is his idea of how race contrasted with nationality. He saw, and I've talked a little bit about how race can be seen as a continuum, you know, starting at the family all the way through tribe and ethnicity, nation, and finally what we call race, or the, you know, the continental races, continental geographic races. Well, Grant took his own issue with the difference and made his own contrast between race and nationality. As I mentioned previously in the preface to the book, he was very explicit to say that European history has never been written, or it has been written in terms of nationality and of language, but never in terms of race, and what he meant specifically by race. Let me expand on this now by reading a little further. In the book proper, he writes, "Nationality is an artificial political grouping of population, usually centering around a single language as an expression of traditions and aspirations. Nationality can, however, exist independently of language. But states thus formed, such as Belgium or Austria, are far less stable than those where a uniform language is prevalent, as, for example, France or England. States without a single national language are constantly exposed to disintegration, especially where a substantial minority of the inhabitants speak a tongue which is predominant in an adjoining state and, as a consequence, tend to gravitate towards such a state. The history of the last century of Europe has been the record of a long series of struggles to unite in one political unit all those speaking the same or closely allied dialects. With the exception of internal and social revolutions, every European war since the Napoleonic period has been caused by the effort to bring about the unification either of Italy or of Germany, or by the desperate attempts of the Balkan states to struggle out of Turkish chaos into modern European nations on a basis of community of language. The unification of both Italy and Germany is as yet incomplete according to the views held by their more advanced patriots, and the solution of the Balkan question is still in the future." It's still in the future today. Here in the future. "Men are keenly aware of their nationality and are very sensitive about their language, but only in a few cases, notably in Sweden and Germany, does any large section of the population possess anything analogous to true race consciousness, although the term race is everywhere misused to designate linguistic or political groups." Well, I would say the same thing today, that the term nation is everywhere misused to designate linguistic or political groups, rather than what the word nation really means at root. A little aside here that he wrote about Belgium. "It sometimes happens that a section of the population of a large nation gathers around language reinforced by religion as an expression of individuality. The struggle between French-speaking Alpine Walloons and the Nordic Flemings of Low Dutch tongue in Belgium is an example of two competing languages in an artificial nation which was formed originally around religion." Later he continues, "The prevailing lack of true race consciousness is probably due to the fact that every important nation in Europe as at present organized, with the sole exception of the Iberian and Scandinavian states, possesses in large proportions representatives of at least two of the fundamental European subspecies of man, and of all manner of crosses between them. In France today, as in Caesar's Gaul, the three races divide the nation in unequal proportions." And he's speaking here, of course, of the races, the European races, Mediterranean, Alpine, and Nordic. "In the future, however, with an increased knowledge of the correct definition of true human races and types, with a recognition of the immutability of fundamental racial characters and of the results of mixed breeding, far more values will be attached to racial in contrast to national or linguistic affinities. In marital relations, the consciousness of race will also play a much larger part than at present, although in the social sphere, we shall have to contend with a certain strange attraction for contrasted types. When it becomes thoroughly understood that the children of mixed marriages between contrasted races belong to the lower type, the importance of transmitting in unimpaired purity the blood inheritance of ages will be appreciated at its full value, and to bring half-breeds into the world will be regarded as a social and racial crime of the first magnitude. The laws against miscegenation must be greatly extended if the higher races are to be maintained. So I think what he's getting at here is, first of all, that what he sees as race, which is these, you know, the sort of sub-races of Europe, it's a concept of race in between nation and continental groupings of race, is that they cut across national boundaries. And this irks him quite a bit. I would still argue that the classic ancient use of the word nation was correct in that it identified more tightly racially homogeneous groups. And in the same way that you could say that the distinction today could be between how well a state's boundaries fit a nation. As he mentions at his time, Spain, the state of Spain sort of matches the nation of Spain. And, well, anyway, I don't have too much very deep to say about that. Again, here toward the end, he gets into his rationale and his motivations for wanting eugenics. And the important, you know, his predictions here turned out to be wrong. National Socialist Germany was the only state that really tried to fulfill this kind of a vision. And it was smashed to pieces by every other European state banding together to destroy it. And no other state has adopted it, anything like this, since. So it's not clear whether it could have ever worked. I think it's certainly plausible, certainly reasonable, what he wanted. And it really is a tragedy that it didn't happen. And speaking of tragedy, here he writes a little bit about the race that he really cares most about, which is the Nordic race. The coasts of the North Sea extending from Schleswig-Holstein, which is the area of Germany that's just south of Denmark, extending from there into Holland, are inhabited by a very pure Nordic type known as the Frisians. They are the handsomest and in many respects the finest of the continental Nordics and are closely related to the English, as many of the post-Roman invaders of England either came from Frisia or from adjoining districts. All the states involved in the present world war have sent to the front their fighting Nordic element, and the loss of life now going on in Europe will fall much more heavily on the blonde giant than on the little brunette. As in all wars since Roman times, from a breeding point of view, the little dark man is the final winner. No one who saw one of our regiments march on its way to the Spanish War could fail to be impressed with the size and blondness of the men in the ranks as contrasted with the complacent citizen who from his safe stand on the gutter curb gave his applause to the fighting man and then stayed behind to perpetuate his own brunette type. In the present war, and he's talking about World War I, one has merely to study the type of officer and of the man in the ranks to realize that, in spite of the draft net, the Nordic race is contributing an enormous majority of the fighting men, out of all proportion to their relative numbers in the nation at large. Well, to this day, that's true. To the extent the United States still has Nordic people in it, they serve in the military in disproportionate numbers. And I can't quote statistics because we don't, the U.S. military doesn't actually count by Nordic types. And in fact, the view today is that this whole idea of a Nordic race is a myth and it doesn't really exist. It's not real. But that's a lie, of course. And anyone with eyes and anyone who reads Madison Grant's description of what comprises Nordicism, what makes up Nordic, a Nordic person, can see who's Nordic, who isn't, by eyesight, at least the ones that are most visibly outwardly Nordic. And you can see them in the U.S. military, and the U.S. military is too white, to use a phrase that's becoming more and more popular in political discourse in the United States today. This or that is too white. Well, nobody really ever points out that the U.S. military is too white, except maybe to criticize it for that, that it needs to reflect the nation better. And sure, I would like to see, for the same reason Grant would have liked to have seen it, that it not be Nordic men on the front line. But that does seem to be part of their nature. It's one of the personality traits of Nordics, that they are natural warriors and make good warriors. Let me read a brief paragraph here, just as miscellany that may fit here at the end. Where two distinct species are located side by side, history and biology teach that but one of two things can happen. Either one race drives the other out, as the Americans exterminated the Indians and as the Negroes are now replacing the whites in various parts of the South. Or else they amalgamate and form a population of race bastards in which the lower type ultimately preponderates. This is a disagreeable alternative with which to confront sentimentalists, but nature is only concerned with the results and neither makes nor takes excuses. The chief failing of the day with some of our well-meaning philanthropists is their absolute refusal to face inevitable facts, if such facts appear cruel. And in fact, nobody could blame Madison Grant for trying to cover facts that he found inconvenient. And that is the problem since Grant's day, is that our leaders would rather cover facts, whether they appear cruel or inconvenient to certain groups of people. And it's always, it seems, the non-white groups that get the preference